Well, this is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the May 8th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes to you the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Last Wednesday, a British judge sentenced WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, to 50 weeks in prison for jumping bail when he took refuge in the Ecuador embassy in London 7 years ago for a crime that allegedly took place in Sweden for which he was never charged nor his extradition demanded. His legal troubles, of course, are far from over. The U.S. is seeking his extradition for prosecution in that courtroom, accusing him of having conspired with then-Private Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, to hack into a Pentagon computer network and trying to help Manning illegally download more classified information than Manning had originally furnished WikiLeaks. That original cache of more than 2 million diplomatic cables and documents exposed secret communications about the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and from U.S. embassies throughout the globe that cast a harsh and unforgiving light on the U.S. role in both wars, as well as Washington's efforts to undermine and destabilize the governments of Syria and Venezuela going back well more than a decade. Assange, now 47, was arrested on April 11th after the Ecuadorian president, Lenin Moreno, withdrew his government's protection of him and allowed the police to take him out of the embassy, drag him out in London, where he had lived since 2012. The same day he appeared in court and was convicted on the charge of skipping bail. Meanwhile, Chelsea Manning, who served 7 years of a 35-year sentence in federal prison for her role in releasing the documents to WikiLeaks, and who has been in jail for the past 2 months for refusing to testify against Assange before a Virginia grand jury, formally asked a court to release her from jail on Monday, saying, quote, "Nothing will convince me to testify," unquote. By an amazing coincidence, Assange's eviction from the Ecuadorian embassy came a few weeks after Ecuador had received a $4.2 billion loan from the U.S.-dominated International Monetary Fund. The domestic response to Assange's eviction and arrest for his extraordinary journalistic achievement has been fairly critical of the Australian gadfly by some who are known here as champions of a free press, including writers for those papers that originally profited from them, and his gigantic cache of U.S. diplomatic cables and documents. In an op-ed in the New York Times on April 27th, Professor Edward Wasserman, a professor of journalism and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, notes Assange's complex and complicated history, but points out that the persecution of him reflects a serious problem that extends beyond him as a single individual, end quote. News is in danger, Wasserman writes, and news isn't a person. It's a process which desperately needs protecting. The element of that process that is most in peril is a source, says Wasserman, and for all his sins, real and alleged, Julian Assange has been one of the most extraordinary sources of the new millennium, end quote. Those are the words and opinion of UC Berkeley Professor Ed Wasserman, who will be my guest on the program at 20 minutes past the hour, when we'll discuss the impact of Julian Assange and the current dangers to those who blow the whistle on government deceptions and falsehoods. Well, on the subject of Julian Assange, I've been disturbed that the media found dissecting his personality more important than actually examining the contents of what WikiLeaks disclosed, which upend what you and I have been reading and hearing on the mainstream media, particularly about Venezuela. What you will find there are cables by U.S. officials that describe how going back to the early days of Hugo Chavez and working through the Republican and Democrat Party branches of the National Endowment for Democracy, how the State Department helped create an opposition first against Chavez and then against Maduro through generous payoffs and propaganda, which I suspect the Venezuelan Constitution would have something to say about. A Puerto Rican friend of whose who has read the Venezuelan Constitution in the original Spanish, writes that it is very clear that the conditions for removing President Maduro from office have not been met, and even if they had, the vice president would be in line to be named as interim president and not a U.S. puppet like Juan Guaido. If you were following the news last week, you couldn't have missed reports of the latest clashes between Israel and the Palestinian residents of Gaza, against whom Israel has launched three wars in the past decade and who they have suppressed under a brutal siege since 2007. 2 million Gazans, because of that siege, have been forced to live in what foreign officials and journalists have described as, quote, the world's largest outdoor prison, and what the UN has repeatedly called a humanitarian disaster. With Egypt obeying Israeli and U.S. diktats and keeping its southern border closed as well, and Israel carefully guarding Gaza's Mediterranean coast shoreline, there are literally no avenues of escape from that prison. No matter. Israel not only has an array of nuclear weapons, it has the most powerful army in the Middle East and one of the most deadly air forces in the world, thanks to the generosity of our bought-off Congress and the indifference of U.S. taxpayers. And what Israel has been doing to the people of Gaza these past days is defended to the hilt, not only by President Trump, but the leaders of both the House and Senate. I'm not going to describe the details of the most recent engagement, other than to point out that armed resistance by a people under occupation against their occupier is considered legitimate under international law, and that Israel used as an excuse to launch bombing raids on the Strip with U.S.-provided F-16s with the wounding of two Israeli soldiers near the Gaza border. What I'm going to do instead to help you understand the mindset of the Israeli military is read to you from a transcript of an April 21st interview with Brigadier General Zvika Fogel of the Israel Defense Forces on the Yuman Hashuva program on Israel's Khan radio, in which the general defends the killing by Israeli army's snipers of a 14-year-old boy who posed no threat of any kind that preceded the shooting of the Israeli soldiers. "Greetings, Brigadier General Zvika Fogel," says the host, Ron Nissel. "Should the IDF, the Israeli army, rethink its use of snipers?" he asks. "That's the impression that maybe someone lowered the bar for using live fire, and this may be the result." "Ron," General Fogel replies, "let's maybe look at this matter on three levels. At the tactical level that we all love dealing with, the local one, also at the level of values, and with your permission, we'll also rise up to the strategic level." "At the tactical level," goes on the general, "any person who gets close to the fence, anyone who could be a future threat to the border of the State of Israel and its residents, should bear a price for that violation. If this child or anyone else gets close to the fence in order to hide an explosive device or check if there are any dead zones there or to cut the fence so someone could infiltrate the territory of the State of Israel to kill us, then his punishment is death?" asked Ron Nissel. "His punishment is death," says the general. "As far as I'm concerned, then, yes, if you could only shoot to stop him in the leg or arm, great. But if it's more than that, then, yes, you want to check with me whose blood is thicker, ours or theirs. It's clear to you that if one such person will manage to cross the fence or hide an explosive device there, but we were taught that live fire is only used when the soldiers face immediate danger," Nissel responds. "Come, let's move over to the level of values," returns General Fogel, as if talking to a schoolboy. "Assuming that we understand the tactical level, as we cannot tolerate a crossing of our border or a violation of our border, let's proceed to the level of values. I am not Ahmad Tibi," says the general, referring to a leader of Israel's Palestinian community. "I am Zvika Fogel. I know how these orders are given. I know how a sniper does the shooting. I know how many authorizations he needs before he receives an authorization to open fire. It is not the whim of one or the other sniper who identifies a small body of a child now and decides he'll shoot. Someone marks the target for him very well and tells him exactly why one has to shoot and what the threat is from that individual. And to my great sorrow, sometimes when you shoot at a small body and you intended to hit his arm or shoulder, it goes even higher. But if that's the price that we have to pay to preserve the safety and quality of life of the residents of the State of Israel, then that's the price. But now, with your permission, let's go up one level and look at the overview. It's clear to you that Hamas is fighting for consciousness at the moment. It is clear to you and to me. Is it hard for them to do?" asked the interviewer on Nissel. "Aren't we providing them with sufficient ammunition in this battle?" "Well, we're providing them, but," begins General Fogel, "because it does not do us all that well for us, those pictures that are distributed around the world," interjects Nissel. "Look, Ron," concedes the Israeli general, "we're even terrible at it. There's nothing to be done. David always looks better than Goliath." That's entirely, and in this case, we are the Goliath, not the David. That's entirely clear to me. It's clear to us that Hamas can't continue to tolerate the fact that its rockets are not managing to hurt us. Its tunnels are eroding. Yes, agrees Nestle. And doesn't have too many suicide bombers who continue to believe the fairy tale about the virgins waiting up there. It will drag us into a war. I do not want to be on the side that gets dragged. I want to be on the side that initiates things, says the Israeli general. I do not want to wait for the moment where it finds a weak spot and attacks me there. If tomorrow morning it gets into a military base or a kibbutz and kills people there and takes prisoners of war or hostages, call it as you like. We're in a whole new script. I want the leaders of Hamas to wake up tomorrow morning and for the last time in their life see the smiling faces of the IDF. That's what I want to have happen, says the general. But we are dragged along. So we're putting snipers up because we want to preserve the values we were educated by, says General Fogel. We can't always take a single picture and put it before the whole world. We have soldiers there, our children, who were sent out and received very accurate instructions about whom to shoot to protect us. Let's back them up. Brigadier General Reserve Zvika Fogel, formerly head of the Southern Command Staff, says host Ron Nessel, thank you for your words. May you only hear good news, General Fogel replies. That was an exchange between Brigadier General Zvika Fogel of the Israel Defense Forces and Israeli radio host Ron Nessel this past April 21st after an Israeli sniper killed an unarmed 14-year-old boy, Palestinian boy, in the Gaza Strip. May you think of that exchange when you read or hear in our media a line that was on the front page of Monday's New York Times that in the recent clashes with Israel said, quote, Palestinians seized every opportunity to wreak havoc. And you may think of that interview when you hear American politicians such as my former congressperson, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, talk about our quote-unquote shared values with Israel. I wonder in what category she would place Brigadier General Vogel's. Pelosi and those running the Democrat Party have been put on notice that its unconditional support of Israel is heading for the rocks. Move On, the country's largest grassroots advocacy group with millions of members, which called on the Democrat presidential candidates not to attend the AIPAC annual conference in March, announced late last month its first endorsements for the 2020 election. They are Minnesota's Ilhan Omar and Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. Both have openly challenged their party's support of Israel while backing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel. Move On said in a statement last week, that it has over 16,000 members in Minnesota's 5th District and that 77% of them backed the Somalia-born Omar, while Palestinian-American Tlaib received the backing of 88% of the 7,000 Move On members in Michigan's 13th District. What does it tell you about who controls our media when you can only find this highly significant story in the Israeli and American Jewish press? Finally, you've heard that the U.S. Navy is sending the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, along with a bomber squadron, toward the waters off Iran, the Persian Gulf, thanks to the efforts of National Security Advisor and his Israel devotee, John Bolton, who, I should remind you, was appointed to replace retired General H.R. McMaster in the Trump White House by pro-Israel mega-billionaire Sheldon Adelson because he didn't consider McMaster supportive enough of Israel. By he, I'm referring to Adelson, not Trump. Not surprisingly, our media has not told you the whole story. It rarely does when Israel's involved behind the scenes, and for that you need to follow the Israeli press in English. So I suspect this is the first time you are hearing that this threat is an Israeli concoction, since Prime Minister Netanyahu would like nothing better than to see the U.S. wage war on its enemy, Iran. According to Barik Ravid of Israel's TV Channel 13 and confirmed by the Jerusalem Post and other Israeli publications, senior Israeli officials told him that, quote, Israel passed information on an alleged Iranian plot to attack U.S. interests in the Gulf to the U.S. before Bolton threatened Iran with unrelenting force should such an attack occur. Bolton's unusual and aggressive statement, said Ravid, including news that the U.S. would move an aircraft carrier to the region. Information about possible Iranian plots against the U.S. or its allies in the Gulf were raised 2 weeks ago in talks held at the White House between an Israeli delegation headed by National Security Advisor Meir Ben-Shabbat and a U.S. team led by Bolton, the Israeli officials told me, said Ravid. An Israeli official told me Mossad drew several scenarios for what the Iranians might be planning, he added, and cited that official as saying, quote, quote, it is still unclear to us what the Iranians are trying to do and how they are planning to do it, but it is clear to us that the Iranian temperature is on the rise as a result of the growing U.S. pressure campaign against them, and they are considering retaliating against U.S. interests in the Gulf, end quote. As I reported to you in an earlier program, the Pentagon and the CIA have been opposed to the Trump administration's recent actions toward Iran, including declaring the Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps to be a terrorist group, fearing that this will endanger U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria. But their reticence has stirred next to no comment in the media. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.